If I could ask everyone to find their seats, please. Thank you. Thank you very much. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the 2010 Kundal Prize Award Ceremony. I'm Christopher Manfredi, and I'm the professor in the Department of Political Science and the Dean of the Faculty of Arts at McGill University. Now, I feel a little guilty about breaking up the wonderful time everyone is having in the other rooms. It reminds me of one of the first times after becoming dean that I went off to do an event at a very elegant home in Toronto. And the home was elegant, the hosts were gracious, the food and wine were wonderful, everyone was having a great time. And I went up to the organizer of the event and asked whether it was time for me to do my decanal duties and speak, and she paused and said, why don't we let people enjoy themselves a little longer before you speak? So I feel a little bit like that. In any event, I'm very happy to be here in celebration of the third Kundal Prize. After 3 years, Peter Kundal's very generous book prize remains the largest nonfiction historical literature prize in the world. The prize awards two Recognition of Excellence Awards, each at a value of $10,000 U.S., which used to be a lot of money, and one grand prize of $75,000 U.S. The prize was established to recognize authors who have published books determined to have a profound literary, social, and academic impact. A particular emphasis is placed on well-written books that have a broad appeal to intelligent readers. As you can imagine, we are very grateful to Peter Kundal for creating this prize. And let me share a little information with you about him. He is the chairman emeritus of Mackenzie Kundal. His career in investment management spans more than 40 years since he graduated from McGill University with a Bachelor of Commerce degree in 1960. He was presented with the Analyst Choice Career Achievement Award as the greatest mutual fund manager of all time. He is a native of Montreal, but lives in London, England. I'm sure he will eventually see the video, so I wish to thank him again for creating this fabulous prize, as well as for the generous Peter Kundal Fellowships in History that are offered to graduate students in the Department of History, some of whom are with us here tonight. The Kundal Prize has given McGill University and the Faculty of Arts a wonderful opportunity to search the world for outstanding books in the field of historical nonfiction. I'd like to offer a special welcome tonight to the winner of last year's Kundal Prize, Lisa Jardine, who joins us. And of course, I'd like to welcome this year's three finalists, who will all receive a more elaborate introduction later this evening. I'd ask them just wave, and so everyone can see where you're sitting. Giancarlo Casale for his book, The Ottoman Age of Exploration. Dermot McCulloch for his book, A History of Christianity, the First 3,000 Years. And Marla Miller for her book, Betsy Ross and the Making of America. All three finalists, of course, are winners because they will all be handed a check for $10,000 U.S. this evening, which is a very nice prize. The grand prize winner, who will be announced at the end of the evening, will receive the additional $65,000 U.S. prize money at a later date. The final decision of the jury was made literally just a few hours ago, and even McGill University can't issue a large check like that on a Sunday. And the grand prize winner will also return to McGill next year to deliver the Kundal Lecture. I would also like to take this opportunity to thank you for your wonderful books and for having been the subject of some very interesting discussions among the jury members. We received significantly more books this year than last year, even though we narrowed the window of opportunity for book submissions from 2 years to 1 year. We still received 181 books, and each book was sent to each of the jury members. In the case of juror Ken White, this is in addition to the 138 books he received while being a member of last year's jury.
and let me say a few words about this year's jury. Ken White, is the author and executive vice president of Rogers Publishing, who served on the jury last year. And he was joined this year by Adam Gopnik, who is also an author and a contributor to The New Yorker. Adam, unfortunately, could not leave New York to join us this evening. Other jury members were last year's grand prize winner, Lisa Jardine, who won for her book, Going Dutch, How England Plundered Holland's Glory. Professor Jardine is the director of the Center for Editing Lives and Letters and Centenary Professor of Renaissance Studies at Queen Mary University of London. Charles Kessler is Professor of Government from Claremont McKenna College in California, Senior Fellow of the Claremont Institute, and Editor of the Claremont Review of Books. And Catherine Devarath is an Associate Professor of McGill's Department of History and Director of the French Atlantic History Group. We hope that most of this year's jury members will sign on for a second year. In addition, I'm pleased to announce that the 2011 Kundal jury will also include Jeffrey Simpson, who is the National Affairs columnist for the Globe and Mail, and Ramachandra Guha, who is an author, a columnist, and a fellow of the Indian Institute of Management in Calcutta. I'd also like to quickly point out this year's advisory committee members, mention them. First of all, friend of Peter Kundal, and of course, friend of McGill, Michael Meehan. Elizabeth Domery, who is now director of the McCord Museum Foundation. Professor Emeritus of History at McGill, Myron Eckenberg. And McGill alumnus Ryerson Simons, a lawyer who divides his time between Toronto and New York. I'm also pleased to acknowledge former jury and advisory committee members who are joining us here this evening, Elizabeth Elborn, Senator Serge Loyal, Desmond Morton, and Denise Chong. Finally, I'd like to mention, in case you hadn't already noticed, that the finalist books are on sale in the main lobby. And now I'd like to say a few words about Michael Meehan and then invite him to the podium. The Honorable Michael Meehan is a member of the Senate of Canada, a Quebec and Ontario lawyer, and a former chair of the Stratford Shakespeare Festival. He is a member of the Kundal Prize Advisory Committee and former chair of the Kundal Funds. He sits on McGill's Board of Governors, and he is the co-chair of McGill University's most ambitious fundraising campaign. Senator Meehan received his Bachelor of Arts degree in 1960 from McGill University. Michael, I invite you to the podium.
Thanks very much, Chris. Thanks very much, Chris. I brought this because my job is to propose a toast to Peter, which I'll get to eventually. No, actually, in a very few minutes. But allow me to tell you really the true story of why the winner doesn't get their prize immediately. It's because McGill's monetary authorities are convinced Canadian dollar is going way over par. And they want to save some money. Actually, we want to save some money so we can advertise even more widely the Kundal Prize next year. And Peter, if you're listening and watching, which I know you will be, this is the only possible area that we could improve, I think, on the whole prize process. We've got to get the word out around the world that this is, as Christopher said, the largest single prize of its kind in the world. That being said, as Chris said, I am a longstanding friend of Peter's, but so are a number of people in this room, all of whom could do this job far better than I am sure. But Peter, as Lisa knows, having met him, and for that I know Peter was very grateful, and all of his friends are certainly very grateful to Lisa Jardine for taking the time to go and meet with Peter. Peter's quite a Renaissance man. He made his way, as Chris said, in the world of finance as a very outstanding value investor. But more importantly, during the middle part of his life, I think I mentioned this last year, tried to learn something new every year, whether it was parachute jumping, playing the piano, Mandarin, you name it. Peter had an annual project, and Peter generally succeeded in achieving a working competency, at least certainly in the case of parachute jumping, enough to get down safely, in all of these fields. And as Lisa knows as well, he's a person of great intellectual curiosity. And history is not his field, but history interests him passionately. He feels that history points the way to the future, illuminates the future, much as careful analysis and balance sheet study does when preparing to make an investment. So there are analogies between the two, and he's hopeful that this prize will mean that more people read more history and have a better appreciation of what's likely to occur in the future and what's because of what happened in the past. So I think that's enough for me. I'd ask you all to charge your glasses. And Peter, we want to drink a toast to you, to your generosity and foresight in establishing the Kundal Prize. Look at this video, see what you've achieved. It's quite remarkable. We're all very proud of you, and we all thank you very much indeed. And good health and happiness. Cheers.
Thank you very much, Michael. So I'm going to leave you now for a while, but don't worry, I'll be back. Please enjoy your dinner, and when we come to coffee and dessert, we'll start the more formal part of the ceremony. So thank you and enjoy. I'm once again sorry to interrupt you, but as promised or actually threatened, I'm back. I hope everyone enjoyed their meal, and as coffee and dessert are being served, I'd like to tell you a little bit about the three special guests who will introduce each of our three finalists. First of all, Malek Abbasab is assistant professor in the Department of History and Classical Studies and at the Institute of Islamic Studies. He will introduce Giancarlo Casale and his book, The Ottoman Age of Exploration. Ellen Aitken is associate professor and dean of the Faculty of Religious Studies. She will introduce Dermot McCulloch and his book, A History of Christianity. And Anne-Marie Adams is a professor in the School of Architecture and the director of the McGill Institute for Gender, Sexuality, and Feminist Studies. And she will introduce Marla Miller and her book, Betsy Ross and the Making of America. And now that the introducers are introduced, let me remind them and the finalists to please keep to their allotted time. The cameras are rolling. So I'm going to ask Professor Abbasab to come up first, and I will ask each of the introducers to come up in sequence after each of the authors has introduced their books so that I can stay seated eating my dessert and don't have to get up every time. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. It's my pleasure to introduce Professor Giancarlo Casale, a finalist for the Kundal Prize. His book, The Ottoman Age of Exploration, is of great significance to scholars of comparative empires, maritime histories, global exploration, and transoceanic exchanges through its unique approach to the Ottoman Empire's expansion in the Indian Ocean. In its theoretical framework, the Ottoman Age of Exploration challenges particular trends in Eurocentrism and breaks down the artificial boundaries between the Ottomans and Western powers, which prevented scholars from exploring their shared historical patterns and cross-cultural exchanges. Comparative study, however, is delicate and rife with difficulties, aside from the fact that it faces resistance and skepticism in several fields. For the most part, Middle East historians, especially those who study Ottoman history, have tended to emphasize the unique or the peculiar in the Ottoman state and its social, political, and military organizations. One of the main contributions of Dr. Casale's study is his ability to treat Ottoman history according to criteria commensurate with those that have developed in studying the history of other areas. As such, Dr. Casali argues that the age of exploration and expansion of the Ottoman Empire shared, to varying degrees, four central features of European exploration. First, geographical and cultural isolation. Second, the development of expansive political ideologies. Third, innovation in military and naval technologies. And finally, an original and inquisitive intellectual endeavor to know the outside world. Dr. Casali utilized a rich array of primary and secondary sources in Portuguese, Ottoman, French, English, and Venetian, and to some extent Arabic and Persian. The end result of his impressive methodological and conceptual delineations is an excellent world history book that connects effectively diverse perspectives from writing early modern history, of which the Ottomans are an organic part. In Dr. Casali's words, the experiences of both Ottomans and Europeans were part of a larger interactive process in which each side formulated ambitious plans for global expansion that followed the same underlying logic, even as the particulars of their respective imperial projects diverged in important ways. Without further ado, please help me congratulate Professor Giancarlo Casali and welcome him.
Hello, everybody. It is with a great sense of appreciation and mixed in with no small measure of surprise that I am here with you tonight. Rather than, I had some prepared comments, but I forgot to print them out. I'm just going to add a little. Rather than telling you about my book, what I thought I would do in my 3 minutes is to just try to convey a sense of how much I feel grateful for this most undeserved honor. And I wanted to do it at three different levels, starting with the most basic level, which is my own experience as a scholar. You can probably tell from appearances that I'm what you would call a junior scholar. And The Ottoman Age of Exploration is my first book, and it was based on my dissertation. So as such, it is the product of almost a decade spent writing and rewriting in a state of almost total despair. In which I was wondering if anybody was ever going to read a word of the book. So to say that I'm pleased doesn't really do justice to how I feel. I think astonishment would be a better word to describe the feeling that I have standing here. I mean, forgetting about the $10,000, just the possibility that all five members of the prize committee may in fact have read parts of my book it's something that far surpasses my most golden expectations. So that's wonderful. Okay, that's my personal experience. Having said that, I think that there's a way in which my own experience as a scholar in some ways mirrors the trajectory of my chosen field of study, which is Ottoman history. Like most fields of non-Western, non-modern history, the Ottoman Empire is a field that has come to maturity only very recently, and I think it's really not used to being the center of attention yet. Until just a few years ago, even, I think it would have been inconceivable that a book about Ottoman history would be included in the same category in a prestigious venue like this with a book about, say, the history of Christianity or the history of the United States. That those are really kind of incommensurate realms. And to a certain extent, that still is true. I mean, if you think about the Pulitzer Prize, for instance, you can't get a Pulitzer Prize unless you write about American history or possibly about some sort of very contemporary world historical topic. So when you think about the Cundill Prize and the range of chronologies and the range of topics of the books that have been selected as finalists over the last 3 years, I think it's really very impressive, and I think that the members of the prize committee deserve a lot of credit for not only for picking me, but also for really helping to redefine what it means to talk about mainstream history in ways that are absolutely critical in this rapidly globalizing world that we all live in. And I didn't get a chance to meet most of the members of the prize committee, but I hope I do at some point this evening. So the last thing that I want to say is now to speak on an even more general level, not as myself, not as a representative of my field, but as somebody who is a practitioner of the humanities in a university setting. I don't think I need to tell anybody in this room that universities right now are in the midst of probably unprecedented crisis, in which there are a lot of very loud voices that are calling for a total restructuring of what it even means to have a university, most of the time in ways that leave little or maybe even no room for the humanities. And for people like me who are very invested in the humanities, this is very disheartening. And it's precisely for that reason that for somebody like Peter Cundill, who has been so successful in the business world and who has made such an investment in sort of the quantitative side of knowledge, for somebody like that to make such an emphatic and generous statement about the value of a discipline like history is incredibly important. And I think that the fact that the Cundill Prize exists at all is exponentially more important than the accolades that it might be able to bring to any particular author or any particular book. And so, to conclude, Mr. Cundill, I know that you're out there listening somewhere on behalf of the humanities, and in fact, on behalf of humanity. I salute you and I thank you.
Good evening. It is an immense pleasure to present to you this evening the second of the three finalists for the 2010 Cundill Prize, Professor Dermot McCulloch, and his masterful book, A History of Christianity, the First 3,000 Years. And it has been an even greater pleasure to turn the pages of the volume, the many pages, and to sip the nectar from so many flowers in this garden of a comprehensive history of Christianity. And we here in Canada can look forward to the arrival of the BBC documentary into which this volume has been transmuted already. The subtitle is, of course, provocative. The first 3,000 years of a religion whose first adherents lived only 2,000 years ago? What is going on here? It provokes us, however, to turn our gaze further back, to explore in the opening chapters the embryonic life of many ideas, practices, and habits of life upon which Christianity would draw in its formation. And then the end of the volume explicitly turns our gaze toward a future yet unknown, as it brings the history up to the present moment and then invites us to speculate upon those ongoing dynamics of responses that will shape the centuries to come. Hailed as the first truly global history of Christianity, this work tells the story, or more properly, countless intertwining stories of Christian life and Christian lives, always with an eye on the local, the particular. It explores the local and particular, moreover, in a way that allows voices and perspectives seldom heard in such a comprehensive history of Christianity. It does so with elegance, courtesy, and respect. The history of cult and culture weaves through a history of ideas and ideals. The writing of history here is truly multicultural, not only in its gaze across the widely diverse regions, languages, and cultures in which Christianity has been embedded, but also in its sensitivity to the diverse cultures of practice and expression in particular times and places, from Syria to India, Ethiopia to Scotland, Tennessee to Korea. An opening quotation from Martin Poeck's 1926 essay, The Christian Life, speaks of organized Christianity as, quote, an unfathomable mystery. It must be related to all knowledge. Professor McCulloch succeeds both in writing a history of Christianity, wherein it is related to all knowledge, and in inviting the reader to taste of the mystery through hymns quoted to capture a moment of understanding, through his attention to architecture and church building, and through his gentle, almost whimsical relating of the peculiar offerings of Christian life. The book invites the reader not only to interrogate, but also to wonder at the intimacy and the intricacy which have characterized Christianity throughout its history. It is now my pleasure to invite Professor McCulloch to come forward.
Mr. Kendall, ladies and gentlemen, historical colleagues, thank you for that generous introduction. When I was a little boy, my parents took me out looking at old churches, but soon they realized that they bred a monster because my appetite for churches was insatiable. No ecclesiastical building was safe from my probings. And eventually I went into therapy for this mania by becoming professor of the history of the church in the University of Oxford. And out of that came a project for this book. And then the BBC, as you've heard, contributed further to rehab by giving me my own TV series on the history of Christianity. And this is 6 episodes, each an hour long. It took around 3 years to get these to the TV screen, at the rate of about 5 minutes on screen for every 12 hours of location shooting. So big project, lot of money, lot of intensity, 3 years of my life on the book and the TV series. Was it all worth it? Emphatically, yes, because historians need to take religion seriously. One or another form of religion matters desperately to the overwhelming majority of human beings alive today. And if historians ignore that plain fact, they are ignoring reality. And Christianity is the largest religion of all, still expanding at a huge pace, particularly in Asia and Africa. And we need to understand where it has come from properly in order to give it some hints as to where to go next. And equally important, what not to say about itself and about other people. Now, no history book is objective, and mine is certainly not. What it tries to be is fair, and also to get rid of myths and wrong perspectives about Christian faith. And it tells the readers who I am, so that the reader can discount whatever prejudices I have and feel safe in moving on, reading the book. I have known in my life Christian faith from the inside. I come from a long line of Anglican clergy, Episcopalian clergy. But now I describe myself as a candid friend of Christianity rather than as a Christian. And Christians and others too need to hear candidly how unexpected is the history of their faith. It is an Asian religion which could have found its home in Asia. Its central city could have been Baghdad and not Rome. And at one stage, that certainly looked like the future. It's a complete historical accident that one form of Christianity, the Western form, has become the dominant one. The Western Christianity, which has become Roman Catholicism and Protestantism. The reality is that there has never been one single church. Christianity has a neurotic obsession with unity, a unity it has never possessed. And given its global scale, its constant encounter with a vast variety of cultures, it would be far better off celebrating diversity. And I want it to help remind it of the ways in which it's changed and accommodated itself to historical circumstances. It would be better for the mental health of the followers of all the great religions if they come to realize that diversity is a virtue, not a vice, an opportunity, not a threat. And so, my aim has been to reach out from the world of university history to speak to the people who pay for it. And they might rightly see that my Oxford theology faculty is an ivory tower if we did not share our knowledge and show people just how exciting it is to find out the reality of our past. Above all, I want my book to leave the reader with questions. Several years ago, I spent a festive evening with a group of friends who included a wise old Dominican friar. Known across the Christian world, his name was Herbert McCabe. And towards the end of our putting the world to rights that evening, Herbert said, "I don't think God is the answer. I think God is a question. I think God is a question." And that seemed to me to get the profound problem of divinity exactly right. A religion which has all the answers dies. Because an answer closes down discussion. There is nothing more to say. But a question remains open, alive. And if Christianity goes on asking questions, it will never die. And my big, fat book is one effort to make it ask those questions. And to explore what a wonderfully varied, unending task it is to seek the past of a great world faith. I hope it's done that. I hope you think so too. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. As Chris said, my name is Anne Marie Adams, and I hail from the Institute for Gender, Sexuality, and Feminist Studies and the School of Architecture, both here at McGill. And the theme of my introduction tonight is the making of legends. To begin, I'll admit that it gives me no small pleasure as director of a feminist studies institute and an architectural educator to be here in the Mount Royal Club, Montreal's first private men's club. Introducing the woman biographer, Marla Miller, of one of America's most famous women, Betsy Ross. Now, some of you may know the club was designed by the architect Stanford White of the New York City firm of McKim, Mead & White, who was famously murdered 2 years after he designed this club by the jealous husband of his much younger former lover. Now, White's legacy as an architect, sadly, rests as much in legends of his womanizing ways and his tragic, violent death as in the Beaux-Arts classicism and fine detailing that characterize the magnificent room in which we sit. That Betsy Ross sewed the first United States flag in 1777 following an unannounced meeting with George Washington is also a powerful legend, dutifully learned by school children across America. It is not based on fact, but rather articulated by Ross's descendants, decades after Ross's death. The evidence or lack thereof of this legend and our incessant appetite for firsts are at the heart of Dr. Miller's splendid biography of the Philadelphia upholsterer and seamstress, Betsy Ross and the Making of America. What I particularly like about Dr. Miller's book is its emphasis on making. She deftly shows us how historian biographers of ordinary women, even iconic ones like Betsy Ross, must invent a different way of writing about their subjects, including deriving information from things rather than texts, since women leave fewer written traces. And indeed, Miller does this through unforgettable descriptions of things that women made. Indeed, Miller has remade Philadelphia from a hard-edged grid of row houses into a plush and silky city of beds, curtains, slipcovers, and, of course, flags. Marla Miller is Associate Professor and Director of the Public History Program at UMass Amherst and a specialist in U.S. women's history, American material culture, and historic site interpretation. Welcome to McGill, Dr. Miller, and especially welcome to the Mount Royal Club of Montreal. Well, gosh, thank you for that lovely introduction. I want to begin, of course, by thanking Mr. Kundle for his generosity and foresight in establishing this prize. And I want to thank the members of the selection committee for all of their hard work in winnowing through that massive number of submissions. And I want to thank their spouses for allowing 180-some books into their homes. And again, thanks to Anne-Marie for that lovely introduction. It's been a particular pleasure for me to meet her tonight because her article on the Eichler Homes is a centerpiece in the course I'm teaching this semester on American material culture. So I feel like I've been talking with Anne-Marie all semester. It's lovely to actually meet with her in person over dinner. That tonight's occasion allows me to meet someone whose scholarship I've admired for so long is one of a long line of strokes of good fortune that have accompanied this project. From the moment I first said out loud that I thought I would write a book about Betsy Ross, so many serendipities like that have come my way. It turned out that a neighbor in the small town that I live in, Western Massachusetts, Hadley, was a direct descendant of Betsy Ross. At a moment during the research when I just couldn't find these portraits from the Ross family that I've been searching for, they turned out to hang in the dining room of a friend in Delaware. So the whole thing really seemed charmed from the beginning. Once I started to look for Betsy Ross, I really found her everywhere. And over in the course of this work, I really felt like I was very much the right person in the right place at the right time. The legend of Betsy Ross, as many of you know, casts the protagonist as a humble seamstress plucked from obscurity to make her nation's first flag. One of the real challenges of writing this book was the way that Betsy Ross is read in today's culture, a figure without historical gravitas, a cartoon character really more appropriate for dolls and dishes than substantive scholarly inquiry. I always say that she's the salt to George Washington's pepper, you know, if you think of the little salt and pepper shakers you can get. I knew that she worked as an upholsterer in 18th century Philadelphia, so I came to this project as a labor historian and a public historian, wondering what it was about popular historical imagination that made it so hard to envision women making furniture. So putting Ross back into that artisanal context in which her life really did unfold was exciting for me. To be sure, I will never look at curtains like those that hang there or the pads on our seats with their lovely piping in the same way. But I'm pleased that so many readers have found the story of women, work, and family, of tenacity, faith, skill, and commitment as moving as I have.
in truth, it's all been really quite humbling. One of the most fun outcomes of this book for me was that it led to an exhibit at the H.F. DuPont Literature Museum in Delaware. And it was a great thrill for me to scout out objects from public collections and private collections, including Betsy's descendants, and see them come together to really touch these totems that seem to speak across the ages. But nothing really has compared to seeing so many of Betsy's descendants at the exhibit opening, seeing their pride and pleasure in knowing, and then my pleasure in knowing that they feel that I treated their family's history with respect. So all of that to say, it's been a real honor and a privilege for me to get to be the one to recover and share this story. I honestly can't get over my own good fortune in coming to this project when I did, and getting to tell the many stories of men and women, everyday men and women from early America who made beautiful and serviceable goods with capable hands. Thank you.
Thank you all very much for those introductions and the wonderful explications of your books. I'm going to ask Michael to join me at the podium, and while he's doing that, and while everyone is still listening to me, I want to do two things. One is to remind all of you that the Kundal Lecture will be delivered tomorrow by Lisa Jardine at the Faculty Club at 4 p.m. The title of her talk is 1688 and All That, Some Lasting Consequences of Going Dutch. There are flyers in the lobby, and books will also be sold at the Faculty Club tomorrow, and I hope that many of you will be able to join us. My last task is a very important one, which is to thank the team led by Joanne Bilodeau at the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, affectionately known as MISC. The MISC has outdone itself once again this year in providing logistical support for the growing Kundal Prize. This involves sorting through the submissions, an onslaught of 1,600 books this year, it's 7 copies of each book, ensuring that they meet the eligibility criteria, shipping the books all over the world, and then coordinating jury meetings with international jurors in different time zones, as well as coordinating travel, media, websites, the Kundal Lecture, not to mention this evening's lovely dinner. So just join me with an applause and appreciation for Joanne and Pete. Now, Mike, is there anything you want to add, Senator Mead?
No, other than to congratulate the 3 finalists. They're all winners, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, why don't I give you the honor of revealing the winner of the prize?
I will read it together.
All right.
Well sealed.
It is.
We had a small wager at our table.
You did. So the grand prize winner of the 2010 Kundal Prize in History at McGill, and the person who will return to Montreal next fall to deliver the Kundal Lecture is Dermot McCullough for his book, The History of Christianity.
Well, I feel I ought to say something, which is thank you to Peter Kundal, and thank you all for being here and supporting this occasion. It is an extraordinary surprise and shock to have been in this event. It's my first time in Montreal. I've had a lovely time anyway. And after my 3-hour walk over Mont-Royal this morning, I just thought that was enough. But to get $75,000 is a rather good end to the evening. And I will go back to Oxford with the most fragrant memories of Montreal, which I know I will now come back to. What could be nicer? Thank you very much.
Could I invite Marla and Giancarlo to join us at the podium as well, please? Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
I should say there's two people from Wisconsin among the finalists, so that's another.
Well, you can share the prize.
Let me thank all of you for being here tonight and helping us honor these three great authors. Enjoy what's left of the evening, and we'll see you all next year. Thank you very much.
Chairman.
Yes.
Before we are adjourned, I wonder if it would be appropriate on behalf of the guests to thank not only our host and presenter, London Theatre, but also to say how very much we, as your guests, have enjoyed this evening's proceedings. It's extraordinarily easy to take these things for granted, but in fact, a great amount of engineering and planning goes into them. And I think it would be very naive on behalf of all of us to take these things, as I say, for granted. So on behalf of all of us, in a rather amateur way, many thanks, and we look forward immensely to seeing you next year. Thank you.